and Grace gets in.
What happened? John Lightheart asks as he turns toward her, one arm resting on the steering wheel.
He is in his white coat, and she notices a tiny bloodstain on his sleeve. I need to hire a nurse to take care of Jean, and I can't go back to the agency. I was hoping you knew of someone.
Days? Full-time?
Live-in.
Well, I'm glad, he says. Now you're being sensible.
No, I'm not, she says, looking directly into his eyes. She trusts him. I'm leaving Jean.
Does he know?
The doctor asks. No. She pauses. Will you help me?
You know I will,
he says, adjusting his position.
But are you sure you know what you're doing?
No, but I have to try.
You're taking the children?
He asks.
Yes.
He gazes down the street, thinking.
There was a young woman who came to us looking for work. I couldn't hire her, though I wanted to. I know she's done live-in care before.
Grace notes the kindness mixed with strength in his eyes, in his mouth. She has only minutes left until the children wake, if they haven't already.
I'll call her when I get back,
the doctor says. I need her tomorrow morning. John raises an eyebrow.
That's awfully soon.
I have to leave before I lose my courage.
It's live-in, room and board and so forth?
And $80 a week, Grace adds.
That's high, the doctor says.
It's for supplies and groceries, too. I'm also hiring a housekeeper.
Well, it's not an offer she's likely to refuse. Her name is Sarah Brody.
Please tell her to come to the kitchen door at 7 o'clock in the morning. He studies her face. He touches her hand.
When you worked at the clinic for a while there, I conveniently forgot that you were married. I thought of you as single.
At times, so did I.
Just remember how strong you are, he says.
After Grace has put the children to bed, she walks into the room that used to be her mother's. The books and the licorice drops are still there. Maybe Sarah will go exploring and find the drops and eat them.
Mother, I'm about to do a terrible thing, Grace says,
again addressing her absent parent. Grace has two letters to write. Dear Jean, this is to tell you that I've gone on a long trip with the children, and I'm not sure when I'll be back. By now you have met Sarah, and I trust you'll mend more quickly in her care. She's extremely capable and well recommended. I have also hired a housekeeper named Peggy. If you think about the last several days, I'm certain you will agree that there's been an unhealthy atmosphere between us, and that it was beginning to affect the children. I will bring them back to you soon for a visit, and I will never deny your right to see them if it can be managed. I've arranged for Sarah's and Peggy's salaries and the bills to be paid by my bank, so you needn't worry about anything. I think that if the fire hadn't happened, we'd have continued as the little family that we were. In time, I believe, we would have come to care about each other in a way that was companionable. But the fire did happen, and that changed everything. I hope you'll be happier and that your injuries will heal. Grace. Dear Mother, by the time you get this, I'll be on a journey with the children. I could call this a little vacation, but I won't. Truth is, I'm leaving Jean and taking the children with me. He's become intolerable, frightening all of us. I have reason to believe that we all might be in danger. I know you'll think this melodramatic on my part, but you'll just have to trust me. I've hired an experienced live-in nurse to take care of him. I'm hopeful that without me in the house and the poisonous relationship that has developed between us, he'll make more progress and be happier. I've hired a housekeeper, too. As soon as I've reached a destination,
I don't know exactly where I'm going right now. I'll call or write you with a phone number and an address so that we can be in touch. I can never thank you enough for taking such good care of the children while I was trying to find my way. And for taking such good care of me, I might add. Don't worry about me, Mother. I've discovered, ever since the fire, or maybe more recently, that I have inner resources I can count on. The check is for you to make a down payment on a house. I can pay for all of it. In my next letter, I'll explain everything. With all my love, Grace. It takes her 3 tries to get the letter into the envelope. Grace lies on the nursery cot. In the morning, she'll change all the linen. She's already rid Merle's room of her personal items and photographs. Ought she drive south to try to find Aiden? If she didn't have the children, she would. She would hunt him down and surprise him, and hope that he reciprocated her feelings. A soloist performing with an orchestra, however, might take her weeks to find. And when she did, she and the children would be a burden, no matter how fond he was of them. But the urge to drive south is a powerful one. To drive west is shortly to encounter John Lightheart at the clinic. She would like to work and keep his friendship. But she can't work and care for her children at the same time, and she doesn't want to relinquish Claire and Tom to a nanny. She herself must raise them and keep them safe. Of less importance, but still critical, is the fact that the clinic isn't far enough away from Merle's house that word of Grace's whereabouts might not somehow get back to Jean. Might Grace be arrested for kidnapping? It seems absurd to her, but she believes Jean capable of anything. To drive east is to drive into the ocean. She will have to leave with no destination then. She won't focus on a place to settle, but rather on the mechanics of freeing herself. Sarah arrives at 7 in the morning in her uniform. The woman has dark blonde hair, blue eyes, and an air of confidence. Grace has made a large breakfast for her and the children. When the kids aren't listening, she asks Sarah to give Jean the envelope with Grace's letter inside sometime after lunch. Grace tells Claire that they are all going on a little vacation, and that Sarah, a nurse, will take good care of Daddy. Claire warms to the idea of a vacation and asks,
"Will there be new toys?"
"Yes," says Grace. While her children chat with Sarah in the kitchen, Grace moves to the library and stares at the paneled walnut door. In this room, she and Aiden once made love. She has never adjusted to the fact that it has become her husband's room, its resonance no longer that of passion, but rather that of sadness and emotional turmoil. Reaching for the brass doorknob, she hesitates before turning it. Only her fingertips touch the metal. Inside, Jean is lying painless and asleep, or he is waiting for his own day to begin. Does he feel remorse of any kind? Grace thought, in a moment of empathy and generosity, that she would go into his room, sit in a chair, and try to talk to him about the terror he was creating in the night for the children. She wasn't going to mention herself, because that was the point, wasn't it? To punish her, to have power over her. She removes her fingers from the knob in case she inadvertently turns it. As if by mere touch she had instructed the door to swing open, Jean stands at the threshold, startling Grace so much that she grabs onto the back of a chair. His jaw is set, he has on clean navy silk pajamas, and he's wearing his eye patch.
"Where are you going?" he asks.
Grace shakes her head, stunned by her terrible luck.
"You were about to come into my room, weren't you?"
She puts a hand to her chest and remembers that she has on a good dress. Not a special one, but a good one. She has fake pearls at her ears. She's struck dumb.
"You're going somewhere?"
An entirely different question from his first one. His vision narrows to a black dot,
but then returns.
What's going on?
He asks, beginning to suspect something.
I was coming to wake you, she says, her voice thin. There's someone I want you to meet. Wait here.
Fighting for air, she enters the kitchen, where Sarah is sitting with the children. Sarah, I'd like to speak with you for a moment. Claire, you stay here and watch your brother. You're a big girl now. When Sarah stands, Grace notes that her back is straight and her legs are strong. The nurse looks like a woman who, while polite, can handle a challenge. There's no time to explain anything further to her, just a moment for an introduction that has only a small chance of being successful.
Jean, I'd like you to meet Sarah Brody. She's an extremely qualified nurse and is going to help with your care. Sarah, this is my husband, Jean.
There's a long moment of silence. Sarah smiles. Jean cocks his head, considering. Does Jean understand? Does he know that he's about to exchange one life for another, and that the other is potentially a better one? His scrutiny of Sarah continues. Then he looks at Grace as if he knew her plans. Before he can say another word, however, Sarah moves in front of Grace, and with a deft turning motion of her hands, she coaxes Jean back into his room. Sarah is more welcome than a vase of flowers, than a wife. Grace lifts Tom and tells Claire to come with her. Collecting one of the suitcases, she hustles her children down the driveway and along the block to the Ford.
Wait here, don't move, she says to Claire.
Grace, crouching, runs and limps as best she can to the top of the drive and collects the second suitcase. With legs shaking and stomach hollow, Grace drives slowly along the coast road as if tempting the hand of God to hook onto the car and haul it back to Merle Holland's house. She remembers the old baby carriage lost in the fire, the one with the navy enameled chassis and the white leather trim, and for a moment she pictures pushing Claire and Tom out of town with steely determination. When she comes to a stop sign, she rolls down her window, sticks out her arm, and bends it at the elbow. She's headed north. Epilogue. 1950. Grace.
What are you doing on the ground? Rosie asks.
I'm trying to take a picture of the stars.
Grace peers through the lens of the camera Rosie and Tim gave her for Christmas.
They're so clear tonight.
Rosie lays a towel on the seat of the teak deck chair and sits.
I can see them with my eyes, but not at all with a lens, Grace adds. The camera isn't perfect.
It is perfect. You've seen the photographs of the kids.
I have, says Rosie. But aren't the stars awfully far away?
I don't get it. The camera is a lens. My eye is a lens. The sun is the same distance from each.
And I can take a picture of the sun. Well, sort of. The stars are the same distance from each, but I can't find a single twinkling dot in the camera.
Not enough light, Rosie says, putting a cigarette to her lips.
Now get up. You'll catch your death.
Grace props her body on her arm and then stands.
My mother used to say that when I was a kid.
Rosie lays another towel on another deck chair meant for Grace.
Thanks, Grace says, fitting the camera back into its case. Have you seen how curious Claire is about this? Yesterday, I let her hold the camera and look through the lens and push the shutter. I can't wait to get the roll of film developed so that she can see her pictures. I'm excited about the idea of teaching her the rudiments of photography.
Don't leave the camera lying around Ian. First thing he'd do is take it apart.
And then he'd put it back together again. He's going to be an engineer one day.
They're both asleep?
Yes, yours? Grace asks.
I left the whole bedtime thing to Tim, Rosie says and laughs. It'll be good for him. He hasn't done it in ages. And if I have to read The Pokey Little Puppy one more time, I'll scream. When Grace arrived in Tim and Rosie's driveway in Nova Scotia during the summer of 1948, she bent her head to the steering wheel while Rosie and Tim, stunned and elated by her presence, took Tom and Claire out of the Ford. Grace had driven straight through, and she was more exhausted than she'd ever been. She hadn't dared to stop for fear that she'd lose her nerve. She was malnourished and dehydrated, and for 2 weeks she lay in a guest room bed, sickened by remorse and guilt, and also a kind of moral anxiety. One day, after much careful attention from Rosie, Tim and she appeared at Grace's bedroom door. Tim sat in a chair and called a halt to the remorse. He told Grace she had a new life before her, as well as happy children. Then Rosie took Grace outside, where they sat together on the rocks by the sea and talked. In that hour, Grace could feel her body repairing itself. Rosie swore it was the sea air that cleared her head. Grace's first act of independence was to design a house for herself and the children. It was constructed on the land beside Tim and Rosie's. Grace's is a simple cape with 3 bedrooms upstairs, painted white and unadorned, white trim, no shutters. Inside, she has a washing machine, a dryer, a bathtub, a shower, and a record player, luxuries she decided she couldn't live without. Both Grace's and Rosie's houses lie on land owned by Rosie's mother. Grace's mother visits twice annually, Christmas and summer. Because the journey, by train and bus, takes 3 days, Marjorie makes a vacation out of it, staying overnight in hotels that appeal to her. Now there's a plan in motion to launch a ferry from Bar Harbor to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, which will cut the time in half. The deck chairs are perched on an invisible dividing line between Grace's house and Rosie's so that they can hear the children. The first warm evening of the season envelops them after a winter Grace can describe only as gray. She thinks gray ought to be a season of its own, running from early January to late April. "Happy gray," she could write to someone on a note card.
"Iced teas," Tim calls from the porch.
"That was fast," says Rosie when Tim reaches them.
"I just tell them to jump in bed."
"And they do that for you?" Tim smiles.
"I confess I took advantage of the novelty of the situation. I skipped the bath and told them a short story. Then I lifted them high in the air and plopped them into their beds."
"That wasn't the deal," Rosie cries. "Now I'll have to bathe them in the morning. They were filthy."
"Nothing that'll kill them. Anyway, I came out here because I have an idea for you."
Grace raises her glass. "First iced tea of the season," she says to both.
"Drink it slowly," warns Tim. "It's really a watered-down, dark and stormy."
"What's the occasion?" Rosie asks, sniffing her drink.
"I was thinking that you need a break."
"A break?" Rosie asks, as if she doesn't know the meaning of the word.
"A break. A trip. You and Grace could go to Halifax for the weekend."
"Both of us?" asks Grace. "Who would watch the kids?"
"We'll let the mothers fight over them."
Rosie takes a long sip. "I have to say, I could really use a break. It's been a hell of a long winter. How about you, Grace?"
Rosie and Tim go to Halifax once a year, but Grace hasn't been yet. Apart from her semi-annual journeys to Jean's house, she hasn't been much farther than the next town over, where a market and shops line a small main street.
Halifax, a city, just her and Rosie.
"Yes," she says. The first trip Grace made to Jean's house with the children, this time stopping to eat and sleep, she couldn't catch any air as she mounted the steps to the front door. She dreaded what she might find behind it. Sarah, the nurse, who was no longer wearing a white uniform, ushered Grace and the children into a room that smelled floral despite the absence of flowers. Jean was sitting upright in a chair and had been fitted with a glass eye. The skin on the left side of his face no longer looked raw, but instead scarred,
which was somehow better. He wore a cap and had cut his hair short so that his head no longer looked as lopsided as it had. The most astonishing change, however, was the moment he bent forward in the chair and stood. In a freshly ironed shirt and pressed trousers, he held Tom's hand and walked with him and Claire into the kitchen, where Grace guessed a snack awaited. "He's improved so much," Grace couldn't help blurting out. "He works hard at it," the nurse replied. "Does he?" Grace suspected it was all Sarah's doing. "How are your funds?" she asked. "Do you need anything?" The nurse blushed. "We don't need anything. Jean has his inheritance now." "We. Inheritance." Grace didn't betray the fact that she hadn't known about an inheritance. She thought, as she observed Sarah, that possibly she and Jean had fallen into a mutually satisfying relationship. Jean had a wife. Sarah's financial future was set. Or was Grace selling the nurse short, and she truly loved the man? A man who had not spoken to Grace when she entered, or even acknowledged her existence. Grace understood then that she was dead to Jean, and a great weight was lifted from her. Grace is content, sometimes happy, rarely troubled or anxious except when the children are sick. She knows the money from Merle's jewelry will run out in time, but she hopes that she can get Claire into school in the fall, thus allowing Grace to look for a job to supplement that income. She'll still have Tom during the school hours, though it's possible she could find a babysitter to allow her to work for some of them. At first, she thought she might try to be a receptionist at a doctor's office, but after Christmas and the camera, she began to dream of becoming a photographer for the local newspaper. She noticed that they often use stock photos, some of them years old, when they print their stories. She doesn't know what such a job would pay, but she doesn't need much. Food and clothing, a babysitter, gas for the car, heating and electricity, and, of course, film for the camera. Both the house and the car are paid for. Even if she could earn $30 a week, she might be able to make it. For some assignments, she could take the children with her. Grace tries to decide what to pack for her trip. She may as well take her best dresses, since she knows Halifax will be more sophisticated than the village in which they now live. Because the temperatures will be changeable, she decides to wear her lined raincoat, a dull khaki. She livens that up with a red leather bag and a pair of red pumps. She refuses to wear rubbers to the city. She puts her spectator pumps in the suitcase, along with a navy purse in case she ruins the red shoes. How odd to pack for only one person. When she's finished, she sets the suitcase by the front door. They'll be leaving early in the morning to take advantage of the 3-day break. The kettle she left on the stove begins to whistle. She carries her tea to her favorite spot, a wooden chair next to the kitchen table that she's arranged so she can see her lawn and garden. Signaling the beginning of spring, the daffodils are up, and she can make out the cracking of the soil where mounds of tulips will be next. The grass is still gray-brown with sporadic patches of green, and in the corner of the yard are dark red shoots of rhubarb. The thought of the red shoots gives her an idea. She'll photograph the garden each day, one photo per day, and date the pictures. Birth, life, decay, death. A complete record. At the very least, the series, though costly, will please her next winter. When the yellow and white bus arrives, Tim gives Rosie a quick kiss while Grace hands the driver her suitcase. Grace has brought the lunches because the trip will take 5 hours. Rosie has on a chic cornflower blue spring coat with pumps to match. "Your coat is terrific," Grace remarks. "Wherever did you get it?" "Would you believe my mother made it for me?" "Yes, I would." "I saw a picture in a magazine. She not only made the coat, she created the pattern for it just from the picture." Rosie has on fake emerald earrings, which draw attention to her red hair. Grace feels dowdy in her raincoat. Rosie reapplies her lipstick after Tim's kiss.
Maybe I'll buy a spiffy coat in Halifax, suggests Grace, knowing that she won't, that she wants to save her money.
Window shopping will be fun. I have a list of all the best department stores. Well, all two of them. But there are smaller shops on Barrington Street we can try.
It feels strange not to have the kids, Grace muses.
Feels good to me. Think they'll be all right? As long as they're still alive when we get back, I'll be fine.
You've stayed at the Lord Nelson, Grace says.
I have. You'll love it. They do a delicious tea. But I've arranged for us to have dinner tonight at the Prince George.
Lord Nelson, Prince George, a delicious tea. How far this seems from Hunt's Beach, about which John Lightheart was correct. Land on the coast, according to her mother, is selling for high prices now. Some of the tin shacks remain, while the houses that were rebuilt by the government are tiny capes, none with fireplaces. How long will those last?
First, we'll get our nails done, Rosie announces.
Our nails done? Just as I'll be digging in the garden?
Now listen, Grace. For 3 days, we are not mothers or garden diggers or housekeepers. We are ladies on the town.
As soon as they arrive at the hotel, Grace highlights her ears with rhinestone earrings and applies red lipstick to match her shoes and handbag.
Nice, says Rosie as she emerges from the bathroom.
After the appointment with a manicurist, it seems they shop for hours, stopping only to have a tea. Rosie takes her shoes off and sticks them among a half dozen packages under the table.
Most of what I bought was for the children, she says, sighing. It's too bad that mint satin with that gorgeous waist was already spoken for. The shawl collar was perfect on you.
But where would I have worn it? Rosie asks, slipping a cigarette from its pack.
Want one?
Rosie, you're not playing the game. You're supposed to buy it because it's beautiful and someday you might have a chance to wear it, says Grace, who takes a lit cigarette and inhales deeply.
These are your rules, by the way. I didn't buy one thing for the children, and I'm feeling guilty.
There's tomorrow.
Tea house scones are always better than the ones you can make at home, muses Grace, taking a good-sized bite. The ham sandwiches they had on the bus barely constituted lunch.
Put the cream and jam on them, Rosie advises. They'll be even better.
You're not eating?
Oh, I will, believe me. Just resting my dogs.
Grace's feet hurt, too, but it's a point of pride not to remove her shoes in a public place.
Now see that man over there at the banquette? Comments Rosie in a low tone.
Don't look now. I think he's exceptionally handsome.
You shouldn't be looking, Grace chastises lightly. You're married.
I'm not looking for me.
You're looking for me? Grace asks, surprised.
You need a man, her friend says.
I thought we agreed you wouldn't do that.
The statute of limitations has run out.
I don't want a man, Grace explains. And that's the truth. And I really, really don't want to be married.
Look, says Rosie, taking a bite of her scone.
You had a bad experience. Get over it.
I am over it. I just don't want the complications.
You're afraid because you think you'll get another raw deal.
I'm not afraid. I like being a single mother. I don't pine for a man or a marriage. I like my own bed. I'm proud of the life I've made.
They walk through a park so green that Grace has difficulty believing in it. Their heels click on the pavement and stick in the gravel. Around them, tulips in provocative colors compete with the dresses of strolling women. They come across a boy in a red cap and bow tie, a dark man in a powder blue linen suit. Grace and Rosie have on dresses with wide, full skirts and have to walk a few inches farther apart than they normally would. Grace admires the park. How can she not?
but she's developed an antipathy to nature in confinement. Banks of perfectly spaced tulips, hedgerows precisely clipped, conical mazes of rose bushes that haven't yet bloomed, fail to delight her in the way they once did. She prefers her garden at home, the one cultivated so close to the sea that the wind whips every bush and flower to its will. She prefers her long and wild forsythia to the neatly pruned balls through which they meander. The sun sets cold on them, and Grace wishes she'd brought something more substantial than her sweater. She's both frigid and ravenous when they step into the dining room, where a fire is lit. Halifax is a schizophrenic city this time of year. When seated, they order winter drinks, Manhattans, not yet ready for summer's gin and fizz. Grace scans the room. The clothes on the diners are not as fashionably cut or as rich in material as those in Merle Holland's closet. Are they still in her closet? But they're a step up from Sunday best. She catches glimpses of yellow chiffon, a gold watch, and earrings so dazzling they might be real diamonds. She notes draped hands with long, painted fingernails. Grace's, too, are newly red to match her shoes. And sometimes, when her hand crosses her line of sight, she's startled by the shiny color. The nails make satisfying clicks on the smooth surface of the table. "Date night," Rosie asserts as she sips her drink. "Don't you think they're tourists like ourselves?" "A little soon for tourists. The weather is too unpredictable. People don't come until mid-June. Tim and I pretend when we come here that we're on a date, but you can't really. Most of the time we just end up talking about the kids, or drinking too much to make the evening feel festive. But you and Tim are so good together." "Oh, we are, but, you know, a marriage is a marriage." "I'm surprised we haven't talked about the children," Grace says. "Not till tomorrow. And maybe not even tomorrow." Rosie offers a cigarette to Grace, who shakes her head.
"It'll steal my appetite, and I plan to indulge tonight."
She orders a shrimp cocktail, a bowl of vichyssoise, and a steak, medium rare, which comes with scalloped potatoes, carrots, and peas. She and Rosie split a baked Alaska for dessert.
"We'd better walk a mile," groans Rosie. "My dress is about to bust its seams."
"Then we'd better walk fast," adds Grace, contemplating the night temperatures.
"We could ask the waiter to order us a taxi."
"Come on," says Grace, standing. "We're tougher than that." They walk with heads bent into a cold wind off the water.
"Want to go dancing?" Rosie asks.
"Tomorrow, maybe. It's been a long day. I was up at 4. Couldn't sleep."
"Too excited?"
The wind picks up. Conversation comes in fits and starts and then is carried away on gusts. Grace passes a granite building and stops. She puts a hand on a column. She bends, unable to straighten. Rosie, 50 feet ahead of her, realizes Grace's absence and returns.
"What's wrong?"
she cries, running the last 20 feet. Grace, unable to speak, not wanting to speak, shakes her head. She knows the moment Rosie understands because she says,
"Oh my."
Grace stands, gathering herself.
"I want to see," she says. "I want to hear."
Rosie checks her watch and then the poster.
"It's half over. I'll see if we can get in."
Grace follows Rosie into an ornate lobby. Though her mind is spinning, she's aware of massive doors, parquet floors, and a ticket booth where Rosie is talking and gesturing.
"We can go in during intermission," Rosie says when she reaches Grace.
"But," she adds, sounding hesitant, even wary,
"are you sure you want to do this?"
"Yes."
Doors open, cigarettes are lit, a crowd rushes for the bar. Rosie leads Grace through an entry and hunts for seats together. The hall is grand with gold leaf carvings, red velvet booths, and a large crystal chandelier. Grace fixes on the impossibly long black piano being rolled onto the stage.
"Breathe," Rosie says when they are seated. "I'm fine."
Rosie raises an eyebrow, removes a compact from her handbag, and reapplies her lipstick. Grace clutches her hands together to stop the shaking. The lights dim. The conductor threads through the orchestra to great applause. Then the soloist, dressed in a black tuxedo, his hair thick and longer than she remembers, sits in front of the sleek machine and waits. A hush of anticipation.
"Breathe," whispers Rosie.
Grace hears the haunting, piercing notes of a French horn and the beautiful reply of the piano. She has listened to the record dozens of times. She can't see Aiden's body or his hands, but she can just make out his face and shoulders. When he begins to play, goosebumps slide down her arms. She feels the notes at the back of her neck, just as she did that first day she walked into Merle Holland's house. She knows the melodies by heart. Rosie reaches over and takes her hand. Aiden launches into a difficult section she remembers well. Grace can pick out the repetitions of the first theme, the introductions of others. What strikes her now is how tumultuous the piece is, how often that tumult is followed by moments of quiet. It's the combination that creates the beauty.
"Your face," Rosie whispers.
Yes, her face must show her rapture, but the soloist, Grace reminds herself, is not hers. He belongs to the orchestra, to the audience, and to the elegance of the concert hall. This is his turret now, his sitting room, his library. This is his life, moving from city to city, entering concert halls and paralyzing audiences. There are multiple sections to the concerto. She listens and sometimes holds her breath. She listens and closes her eyes. She listens and knows that the end is coming and that she is again powerless to stop it. The audience is on its feet, clapping. Rosie and Grace join them. Aiden Byrne takes 3, 4 curtain calls, sweeping his arm to include the orchestra. When he leaves the stage the final time, the lights come up.
"You're crying," Rosie says. "It was beautiful. It was amazing."
It's a few minutes before Rosie is able to lead Grace out of the concert hall. When they have moved away from the din of the crowd, she turns to Grace.
"That's him, isn't it?"
Grace embraces Rosie.
"He's magnificent," Rosie whispers in her ear. "In every way possible. You lucky girl. You lucky, lucky girl."
She draws away from Grace.
"Come on."
Rosie takes Grace to the back of the concert hall, where already there's a crowd. Men and women have programs and pens in their hands. Grace will have one more glimpse of the man who was once her lover. While they wait, the cold penetrates Grace's shoes and blows through her sweater. She shivers, a combination of the temperature and nerves. She can't manage the business of smoking, so she hugs her sweater close. The murmuring grows louder, and Grace watches as the stage door opens. A man steps out, not Aiden, but he beckons to someone inside. Aiden emerges and stands on the stoop, an iron railing running around it and down a short set of concrete steps. The murmuring breaks up into individual pleas to sign programs. Grace knows the moment Aiden sees her, because his face blanches, and then his color is restored. He descends the stairs and moves toward her, gently parting the crowd, and Grace knows, in the time it takes for him to reach her, that her life is about to change. She can see it all, the astonished but happy gaze, the kiss, the night spent together, the promises and plans they'll make.
He'll learn to fly, he'll say, so that he can see her more often. Grace will travel to attend some of his concerts, she'll say, and she'll wear a cloth coat. Aiden will come to her house, and her children will perhaps remember the man who made music and played with them. Aiden will buy a piano and install it at Grace's so that he can practice when he comes home and sleeps with her. She'll have a life she could never have imagined, a life different from anyone else's. They will be lovers whenever and wherever they can. They will never be separated, no matter how great the distance between them. He reaches her and takes hold of her wrist.
Hello, he says.
Grace meets his eyes. Aiden, this is my friend Rosie.
Hello, Rosie, he says with a smile.
Rosie grins. Your concert was wonderful. Aiden, not letting go of Grace, invites the two of them to dinner. Before Grace can explain that they've already eaten, Rosie begs off.
I've had a headache since this afternoon. Blissfully, it went away during your concert, but now it's back. I think I'd better go lie down.
Grace turns to Rosie.
I might be late, she whispers. I certainly hope so.
It occurs to Grace, as she watches Rosie walk away, that she could be wrong, that what she imagined moments ago might not come to pass. She and Aiden will have dinner and talk, and he will see her back to the hotel and promise to let her know when he is next invited to play in Halifax, which will never happen. But the grip on her wrist is fierce. This is Suzanne Elise Freeman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Stars Are Fire by Anita Shreve. This program was directed by Bruce Mann. Executive producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2017 by Anita Shreve, Inc. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.